Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. We've got, again, I think it's more of like a TV tray or a coffee table versus a round table. Matt Kachansky is actually on PTO this week and taking a little bit of time off, although he has been answering emails and calls, so I don't know really. I think he's just ducking us. But anyway, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and one of the directors, managers on our SIU team. And today we want to talk about, there was a report that came out in May of 2024 regarding DME. And everybody's heard about Operation Brace Yourself and kind of the ongoing things that were going on with DME and the like. This was an OE&I, Office of Evaluation and Inspection audit that was done. And for those that aren't really conversant with OIG operations, there are three main components of the OIG. Office of Investigations, where Wade and I were the badge and guns. Office of Audit Services, they do audits primarily of facilities, hospitals, things of that sort. Identify potential areas where CMS or whatever the program is didn't fully enforce what it should have been. Those are mostly the bean counters, CPAs and the like, a lot of people with pocket protectors. And then the other main component is the Office of Evaluation and Inspection, OE&I. And they do empirical studies. A lot of the people that work at OE&I are social science majors and things of that sort. And they do a bunch of empirical studies on program weaknesses and things of that sort, where they'll issue a report about, you know, maybe where CMS could have, would have, or should have done something a little bit different to tighten up payment structures and the like. So we want to kind of revisit from a little bit more of a global fraud, waste, abuse perspective this discussion from this study that looked at 2018 to 2020 DME. Over $1 billion was paid out for DME, durable medical equipment, mostly braces and the like. And, you know, what they identified was that for the most part, Medicare was paying for off-the-shelf related durable medical equipment, but custom DME was being billed. And so like a simple example is the patient gets from the DME supplier, they get like a Dr. Scholl shoe insert, cushioned insert, but a custom orthotic, molded custom orthotic, which could cost, you know, $800-$900 or more dollars in reimbursement, gets billed, but that's not really the case. And then the other component of this that they found was this whole premise of providers not having a prior relationships with the patients. And we knew that. We've been talking about this on podcasts going back forever and a day, and the issue involving the 12-month rule. And OE&I actually looked at that, but they looked beyond the 12 months. In the study, they identified instances where the providers did not submit a claim for a visit with the patient, an evaluation and management or an office visit, something in that 9-9 range for an existing patient, a 9-9-2, whatever it may be, for a new patient, a 9-9-2-0, whatever it may be, 2-3-4-5 versus an established patient, 9-9-2-1. You know, 2-3-4-5, and that just didn't happen. And so, you know, obviously, Wade, the first thing that comes to mind is how is it that these frauds get to be perpetuated? And the very simple answer from a data and policy perspective is you have 12 months to submit a claim. And so, you know, you don't know that a claim is necessarily fraudulent on its face until after that 12 months, right? And then you run into these problems. But, you know, we've talked a lot about these issues, and we've talked a lot about the fact that if CMS shortened the time period, that would give UPICs, investigators, and the like, it would give them the ability to look at least retrospectively, but in a shorter period of time than those 12 months. And that could help to do that. But the thing that I really want to talk about, and we've been talking about this on a bunch, and you reminded me, we talked about this when I was doing the retro fraud podcasts, and you were on for that, and we've talked a lot about that, was the silliness of one of these docs that they identified was a doctor who was a radiologist out of California. And in a one-year period, he submitted, he was the referring, he didn't submit a single claim, he was the referring provider for 20,000 pieces of DME, 20, 30s, 20,000, because I had to read that twice because it was insane. And he was writing orders for an average of something like 51 braces a day, every day, for an average of something like 21 beneficiaries, which amounts to about 2.5 pieces of DME a day per person. And of course, you know, the doctor wrote script, he wrote orders, or was the ordering physician. So we won't say he wrote them because we don't know. He could have been involved in one of the kickback cases, but patients in 44 states. So he hit nearly every state. And of course, obviously, everybody says, well, this should have, could have, and would have been prevented had the rules been different. But, you know, certainly from the analytics perspective, from the investigator's perspective, you know, we are scratching our heads when we look at this and we say one provider, 20,000 as the referring, notwithstanding the fact that a provider has 12 months to do this, you know, he's a radiologist. His specialty is radiology. His NPI is going to go back to his specialty code as radiology. And he's in California and he's writing for 44 states. It is kind of a head scratcher, but from an investigative perspective, like, what are some of the avenues that you could think of off the top of your head, you know, that you could start to chip away at that?
Well, I think it reminds me of cases that we worked in Los Angeles. I worked as an agent and supervised cases as an ASAC. And what we found out, and I think that's probably partially going to be the case here, is there's some degree of medical identity theft involved in most cases, where like most like physician provider is not going to be writing it. I mean, it's such an outlier to be writing scripts for patients in 40 different states. It's just, it doesn't make, like you say, it doesn't make any sense. So probably what happened in this case, I'm guessing, is that the, not the actual provider, but like a, more like a businessman who owns the DME company, got a hold of this doctor's credentials and started just billing for stuff, you know, probably not providing it at their, the patients probably didn't get all these braces, but once they get the doctor's referring information, they can just, they have carte blanche to bill whatever they want. And we had one case where it was a kind of a long story, but it was an undercover case where we had an informant working with these providers who were, they weren't like doctors or physicians, but they were DME company owners and they were businessmen basically. And they explained it to us in pretty clean, clean terms of, they would say, well, we're going to get this provider and at this clinic location, we're going to control him. They would basically get patient lists and that type of thing. And they would bill for these claims, but then they explained to our informant, so we control him here at this location, but then we take his information, do a change of address or whatever, we get another provider number at a different location that the physician doesn't know about. So he said, and he's explaining it to our informant that now we can control him at this location where he knows he's working and we're giving, you know, patient lists and that type of thing. But this other location, he doesn't even know about. So we can bill whatever we want, bill Medicare. And when the feds come asking questions, he can't say anything because he doesn't even know about this location. So right. We would go to different clinics and we'd find out later that we had, you know, the doctor as our target, our subject. A lot of times we found out later that they don't even know that this other place exists. And it's somebody else who's
right.
Submitting those claims. They're not actually billing or they're not actually providing the braces, or in this case, it was like a thoracic lumbar sacral orthosis, which was another, it's expensive because it's supposed to be custom fitted. And it wasn't, they just had a hard plastic body jacket that they would provide. And it was, you know, $1,600, $1,800, something like that. But to go back to your question, I think in this case, there's at least some degree of medical identity theft on the part of the physician who's supposedly billing for these, probably didn't know about a lot of them.
Right. And in some instances, the medical identity theft is voluntary, right? If you have this provider as part of the fraud scheme, he's willingly giving it. But the thing that's interesting to me is that the study was from 2018 to 2020. I didn't go and look at the granular dates, but what's interesting is we hit the public health emergency in March of 2020. And that's when there was that expansion of telemedicine. So this is actually what makes this unique, is that this is during the period of time when it was before the public health emergency and the old rules regarding telemedicine existed, which were very, very restrictive from the CMS perspective. So it is interesting that that was the case. But to me, the bigger red flag is this doc is a radiologist writing for patients in 44 states. And, yeah, you know, unless you've got a license in all those states and, you know, all of that, but, you know, 44 states, I think for me, my perspective would be this wasn't an identity theft in the traditional sense. This was a provider who was getting paid an amount of money to do, you know, to sign off on these, because the money becomes an addiction. You know, I remember the very last arrest I made before I retired involved a doc who was writing scripts for compounded medications, and not a single interaction with the patient. None. In fact, the funny thing about it was the telemedicine company was really a marketing company.
Yeah.
And they were calling, and they were the ones that were getting the scripts completed. And then they were sending them to this doc's Yahoo email address. And they were so many of them, and they didn't have like electronic signature. There were so many of them that he couldn't print them up at home. So he was forwarding them to one of the big box office supply stores. Yeah. And he would go every day, and they would have a folder for him. And so there's all kinds of HIPAA violations going on. And we went to the big box store with a picture of the doc, and said, just by happenstance, just showed up and said to the person behind the copier, do you recognize this guy? And the person said, oh yeah, that's Dr. Bernard. He comes in every day, usually at about 4 or 5 o'clock. I give him the folder, he signs them, he gives them back to me, we scan them and we send them back. But the funny part was we found within the doc's emails that there was a period of time when the prescriptions had his cell phone number on them. And he was getting phone calls from patients because they didn't know who he was and they were getting these prescriptions. And he writes this very long email to the telemed marketing company and says, please stop giving my cell phone to these people. I don't know who they are. I can't talk to them. It was like you just kind of laughed. But, you know, it does beg the question of, like, how does this happen, right? And the problem I think we ultimately get down to is 12-month rule to submit a claim. And the other piece of it is the claims rule. Now, you know, I would argue that if I was being asked my opinion of data analytics and algorithms with geospacing and geofencing and licensure checks and things of that, like, we'll never know the answer to this question because we're not on the inside anymore. But the question really is, how does this happen, right? You got a doc in California writing scripts to the tune of 20,000. How does that not rise up in some way? And then collaterally, how is it that 44 states worth of beneficiaries are getting it? And how is it that he's writing 20,000 over, you know, 2.5 per? So, you know, we'll never know the answer to these things, but certainly, you know, once you get this case, whether it be on the SIU side, the OIG side, there's a ton of things you can do, right? Beneficiary interviews. Did you get this? What did it look like? If you've got a beneficiary who's savvy enough and they can take a picture and email it to you, you know, hey, yeah, that Dr. Scholl, or, you know. So talk to me a little bit about, like, for example, like from an evidence perspective, I loved going out in the field, interviewing someone and having them say, oh, I'll be right back. And they come out a minute later and they've got a basket full of medicine and they have no idea, or they have the back braces or that. You know, I think the piece that sometimes SIU investigators who primarily work in a desk environment don't think about are those, not necessarily thinking outside the box, but the questions of, like, you know, have you ever been to California? Do you know this doctor? Have you ever, you know, had a problem? Or do you still have the devices that you got in the mail? Do you have a cell phone? Can you take a, like, some of those probing questions that I think people just need to be educated about, right? Because those become some of your best pieces of evidence.
Yeah. And we would see a lot of times too with, like, the beneficiaries, you touched on I think it's a very important part, is there's, like, certain degrees of, like, collusion with the whole identity theft situation. And you generally, the way it starts with what we were seeing in California is they're approached by somebody, a marketer, a capper, we used to call them, and they'll give them something of value. Could be, a lot of times it was just, they'd take them to lunch. They'd take them to lunch. They say, hey, I need your Medicare card. But once they have that information, you know, they were maybe in collusion. They knew that they were going to get some free, you know, power wheelchairs, whatever it was at the time. But they knew that they didn't need it. They didn't have the medical condition, no medical necessity. But once they kind of give up that number, now that the cappers and marketers have their Medicare number, now they can go and they can bill whatever, and the beneficiary is maybe not complicit with all these future bills that are coming, you know, down the road. But once they gave it up, it's the horse has left the barn situation. You know, it's like they can't reel it back in. And that's right. I think what happened a lot of times.
And you know, the other little piece of this puzzle is that oftentimes, you know, what I found was that when you speak to the beneficiary or the member in your plan, and they get these things, whether it be this DME or these prescriptions, you know, I remember seeing instances where, like, literally people would bring out a basket and there would be jars of ointments, potions, lotions, and creams that would just keep coming. Yeah. And I would say, you didn't question the doctor's name. And they would say, no, I have shoulder pain. On the jar, it says, put this cream on 3 times a day for shoulder pain. I thought that this doctor was working with my doctor and was a referral. Like, you know, the whole social engineering piece, yeah, that comes out of the marketers, you know, on doing these questions that come over these telephone calls or whatever it may be, really give people this false sense of that this is a legitimate thing. You know, my other favorite, particularly in the DME space, was when you would show up to someone's house and they would go in their closet and they would pull out, you know, I think you called it like the hockey player, right? Where they had every brace imaginable. And, you know, or my favorite would be the person in the wheelchair who was a double amputee above the knee or a double amputee just below the knee, but in a wheelchair, and they have not one, but two braces. Or they're a single amputee and they have a brace for the right leg and they're a right leg amputee. Like, you know, right? Like you see these things and it just kind of makes you go, huh. But, you know, just from that investigative perspective, sometimes it's these simple questions that you can ask to get these answers, particularly because the social engineering piece helps you to understand, right, that the backstory.
Yeah. And we had one Medicare beneficiary. She was elderly, I think she was just like 85, 86, something like that. Filipino woman, weighed about 90 pounds, very small person. And we were interviewing her about some DME she had gotten, and it was back to that TLSO back brace situation. And she brings out her back brace that was delivered to her, and she didn't need it, but it was like a XXL size. It wasn't custom fitted any of this, but it was just a hard shell back brace, basically extra large. And we had her put it on, and we took a picture of it, and we actually ended up using that for a congressional hearing on these frauds. That, you know, she's this very small person wearing this huge, you know, back brace. Clearly it's just for, you know, billing purposes. It had no medical value to her. She didn't need it, but it was, they didn't even bother to get her like something that could actually be used. Like, it was just, she was swimming in it. So it had no medical value to her at all, but we were able to use that in a congressional hearing, which was, I think it was eye opening to the members that were, you know, part of that hearing.
Right. Right. And you know, the thing that's interesting about that is, you know, that's great evidence, right? This is supposed to be a custom back brace, wrist brace, whatever that thing is. And, you know, you show this, you know, 90-year-old, 100-pound grandma, and she's putting on, you know, it's like when you're a 5-year-old kid and you're putting on your dad's shoes,
exactly,
right? Swimming in them, and it just doesn't, like, it's just obvious, right? The obviously the easy questions to ask your beneficiaries when you're interviewing them, whether it be in person or on the phone, particularly when it's a custom piece of equipment, is, did you do anything before to get this? right? Particularly like a shoe insert. Did you get the mold? Did you get this? Were you measured for the back brace or something like that? Like some of those are easy. Obviously, if the person lives in, Florida and the doctor is in California, the very first question is, do you know who this doctor is? Have you been to California? Or are all your doctors here in Florida? So, I think for me, when I see these studies, they sometimes become, I think, like everybody who's in the FWA space, like we are, you become frustrated at the fact that these studies are constantly reinventing the same narrative, right? We talked about this in Retroforum, and I talk about this all the time. It's the same circus, it's just different clowns. And it's like nothing really changes, but what we see is kind of these studies that continue to show, where there was a weakness in the program or where there was this, was that, to some extent from the Office of Investigations perspective, I mean, that's job security because there's always going to be another person that's going to reinvent that wheel to do the same thing. But as a person in the space, it's just frustrating for me because that there are things that could be done and it kind of just begs the question of, I get it. I get that there's 12 months before you can, before that claim goes away. If I'm the E&M provider, the doc or whatever it may be, the nurse practitioner, whatever it may be, PA. But at the same time, it's like, how is that not rising to the top? Like how are 20,000 not creating a threshold problem? Because even if you are, think about it, even if you're an orthopedist, physical medicine and rehab, pain management, you're some doctor who would likely order some of these items, these products. Are you doing it to the tune of 20,000? Are you doing 51 a day? Three different braces. I mean, I could see if someone has osteoarthritis, two knee braces maybe, but, at what point is 3, 4, 5, at what point is the hockey player look? Right. And so I think from that perspective, it's frustrating for all of us because we're like $1 billion was paid out, for these. And probably most of it was not legitimate. But it does say from the SIU, we can't control what any of these are, how any of these work. But I think, at least from the SIU perspective, I would certainly say I'd be certainly recommending to my data team that some of the algorithms be tweaked, that there should be a flag for, when a provider hits a certain number or, geospacing and things of that sort. What are some of the, as we kind of wrap up on this abridged version, what are some of the things, what are some of the key, from a data perspective, what are some of those key things that you think should immediately raise red flags?
Well, one that you pointed out, which is, it's like, a very obvious one, and when there's no previous history, so it doesn't pass the smell test. If the beneficiary has never been to this doctor before, there's no history of previous billings, E&M codes, or whatever, and the first thing that they do is they bill for a brace, a knee brace, a back brace, whatever. But they've never seen them before. That doesn't make sense. I mean, there should normally be like some other things they tried first. They diagnosed them with something and they might do a brace right away, but when there's no history at all, and that's an easy like algorithm to be able to show that and pull out the claims. It's like, these are, show me all the claims where this brace was billed, but there was never any previous history. That's pretty easy. And that can be from an SIU like desk audit, as opposed to an OIG where you're out there in the field interviewing people and doing surveillance and all these things. That's easy to show that there was never any other claims submitted by this physician.
But the downside to that is if you've got that 12-month period of time, that's kind of the only, that's the thing that kind of, negates that. But, for me, I'm thinking in terms of the doc in California in the study, 44 states and 20,000 braces, someone, it shouldn't just be like two cats driving a car. I mean, there should be an adult in the room to kind of say, hey, what's happening here?
Because it does look for outliers, and there's nothing more of an outlier than billing in 40 different states. I mean, that just doesn't make sense.
it's a huge outlier to me, and 20,000 in a year is a huge outlier, and a specialty like radiology where you don't really expect the provider to be ordering, forget billing, but ordering. Because right. I don't know, you know, a radiologist, you know, what are they doing? What kind of E&Ms are radiologists doing where they would even be ordering something like that? Unless they're cross-trained, they maybe they're double board certified, maybe they're radiologists by day and they're working somewhere else at night. And that may be fine and well, but it's, you know, you're limiting the number of hours in the day that you're working. If your primary job is working as a radiologist and yeah. you look at that provider's billing. So, you know, I think, you know, when I look at these studies, they become frustrating because it's a constant reiteration of things that we already know to be problematic areas. And to me, it's starting to become a little bit of the definition of insanity. Continuing to do the same thing and hope for a different outcome, because the outcome is not going to be the same. And we see it with, it's not just DME, right? We see it with genetic testing. We saw it with compounding. We see it with remote patient monitoring, the glucose monitors, the constant glucose monitors, where it's all done through mail order, through DME suppliers and the like. So, you know, I think that from the SIU perspective, and we talk about this all the time, this is great for intelligence gathering. It's looking at what historically has been going on and looking to see how you can create a more robust environment for what you've got currently. And so it's making sure that you've got that tweaking of data. Notwithstanding, right, the fact that the provider has 12 months to submit a claim on the Medicare side, you know, whatever the individual plan policies might be. But the fact that the provider didn't submit a claim, you still have a bunch of information from the DME supplier on the referring provider and all of that. You know, I think for the commercial plans that are out there, they may not be seeing it to that level, that breadth or that depth. But certainly, if you've got a radiologist in California and all of a sudden you're starting to process claims in your commercial space for DME, and your member lives in New York and it's a doctor in California, like that should raise a flag immediately, like what's going on with that. Particularly even in the world of telemedicine, like, you know, I don't know if ordering a piece of DME for someone from a telemedicine visit, you know, what does the doctor say? Like, you know, move your wrist this way. Does that hurt? Okay, you need a brace, right? No x-ray, no nothing. So there's a lot of challenges to do in these cases, but certainly I think there are some things that investigators can do. Read these studies, read these reports, read the press releases that are out there, because they're going to give you a lot of insight on where a fraud scheme can be identified in the data. You know, it is amazing to me that we do nothing but massage data. And this is data that was out there, and, you know, continues. It's a little bit like the $2 billion DME case that involved, you know, the recent one with seven shell companies. Like, the information is there. How do you see, you know, how does no one see a spike in billings from a DME supplier that sold wigs for cancer patients to the tune of about $50,000? All of a sudden, they're billing millions of dollars. How does someone not notice that, right?
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Well, we'll continue to look at these studies and we'll continue to pontificate about them, and we'll continue to provide our suggestions, hints, tips, and tricks for people to not listen to us.
That's right.
It's just kind of the way it is. So, as always, it's good to see you. For you those too. Of you that are traveling, and hopefully you're out of harm's way for the storm. Today is Wednesday when we record this. It'll be out on Friday in our newsletter, but the hurricane is a coming. I'm up at my place in New Jersey, so away from it, and normally we're in Orlando. Hopefully it won't hit too bad by the time it gets to Central, but you know, hopefully everybody does well with that, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you.